Welcome back to season two of Snubs and Dubs, where we've been talking about the snubs and dubs of the 87th Academy Award for Best Picture. I'm your host, Kyle Tobias, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Miller. Jason, how many Wordle-esque things do you do in a day?
Okay, it depends on the day. Wordle, pretty much a lock, although I lost my streak probably like a month ago. So now I only do it if I like have time and think about it. I'm not going on my way to do that anymore. If I have a group chat where we send so many different variations. There's like the music one.
Oh yeah.
There's the movie one. There's Wordle normal. And then we've just like experimented with other ones. So in a day, I'll probably do two, especially if someone sends a good score, I'll be like, oh, I got to try my hand at whooping your ass in this.
Like I sent you framed the other day.
And I whooped you in that frame.
By one, okay? By one.
Dominated. You try and get the Game of Life screen from Gone Girl past me? No. I did not know the first one. Like the first frame coming like, I'm burning this one. I'm punting to number two. And I honestly, I felt really proud of myself. I mostly recognized it from the lighting and the lens, the color palette.
The palette.
I'm like, oh, I do recognize this.
Good for you.
But today's, which I will say, because this is like a week from when we actually recorded, it was 300. Try five. I sucked.
Really? Oh,
Little secret. I've never watched 300.
See, that was me for the longest time until finally I was like, why haven't I watched 300 yet? And I just watched it.
Solid
though. But that was a year ago and I kind of regret it because it was not that great.
Like, no, I'm sure the hype for it has well surpassed what the movie could possibly be now. Kind of like the main message of 300 when you think about it.
Really makes you think. Yeah.
How do you do?
I tend to do Wordle every day and I've mostly only been doing framed. I haven't done any of the songed ones, but I did just find another one called Movie Dull. Which sounds like framed, except instead of showing you an individual frame, they show you an entire movie in like 1 second. And it's like a clip.
Sick.
And so you have to like watch it and see if you can pick it up before it like ends and then put it in. And so far I've been 2 for 2 first try. So I recommend testing that one out. But
interesting.
Did you watch any full length movies this last week or... I mean, I was the only one that watched the 1 second ones, but
We watched one together.
We did.
It was fun. It was
the unbearable weight of massive talent.
There we go. The unbearable weight of massive talent. It was fun.
It was.
It was just free love and fun. There's action. There's comedy. There's a whole lot of Nick Cage on screen. I had a very pleasant time.
Me too.
That's a movie that exists in our world.
I was thinking about it afterwards and as much as it is about Nick Cage and it's Nick Cage's movie, that movie probably does not work as well without Pedro Pascal.
It needed Pedro Pascal.
Fucking killed it
too. Oh my God, he murdered it.
Their like banter and their chemistry together was just unbelievable. It was so good. And I really want to watch it again because it's just a fun movie.
It's just a fun movie. Yeah. I want to just go with someone who hasn't really heard anything about it and just see their reaction to it too. Because I was not prepared for what that movie was going to be about. I think it tried to mislead the audience into thinking it's going to actually be biographical about Mr. Cage. It ain't.
No.
Or it is.
Kind of.
It might be.
It's like a fictional version of Nick Cage that is Nick Cage.
Yes.
Because like Nick Cage in real life doesn't have that family. Like that's not his real family.
Okay.
And so it's kind of like playing off of his real life, but also like what people think of him and what like his persona is, especially across different areas. Cause he's like sees his younger self and that persona is like totally different. And so it's not like true and true. Like this is a Nick Cage biopic. It's just like, this is the character of Nick Cage being played by Nick Cage. And it's great.
I choose to believe everything happened. I choose to believe 100% accuracy in that and I will not be shaken.
Yep. Is that the only thing you watched though?
Well, I did just do the movie doll. So I've now watched two movies.
Did you get it?
First try.
Yeah, nice.
Not a hard one.
Nice. Yeah, no, you see, I mean, it'll be weeks by the time that this is out, but you see Deadpool.
You see Deadpool.
In the second, and then you're like, oh.
Oh, it's like, oh, this is either Deadpool 1 or 2.
Yeah, exactly.
It was 1.
Yeah.
What else did you watch, Kyle?
Well, Molly and I have been slowly chipping away at Demon Slayer. So we got through the first season. She had seen, she's watched it. It's like on autopilot on her TV, I think. She just like, every time I ask her what she's watching, it is Demon Slayer. I'm like, haven't you watched that through like four or five times now? And she's like, yeah. But
still more
anyways,
demons though.
So,
demons we, ain't slain yet.
We finished season one. At least I finished season one. And it's a good anime, but it does fall victim to a lot of the anime tropes that I don't like, which is they spend so much time like narrating or in their own heads or elevating, like floating in the air, talking about random shit and thinking about a moment before it happens. And like, it's so much blabber in that regard that like sometimes it's easy to get taken out of the episode.
Yeah.
Because like it's, this is going to be like a 10, maybe 5 minute fight, but it's drawn on for a half an hour because there's so much going on in flashbacks and learning backstories for characters that are just going to die in the next 2 minutes anyway.
Being murdered.
Yeah. But it's really cool. And, I mean, I would recommend it. I'm about to, we're going to watch the movie, which is apparently between season one and season two is this movie. I've heard good things about this movie and also good things about season two. So I'll report back next week.
I'm excited to hear the report. I expect a full book report style presentation that you'll give to me with visual things, but it needs to also carry through just audio for the listeners as well.
So I'll just vividly describe every individual frame that I show you.
Please.
Okay.
Yes.
Gotcha. But that's all I watched, except for the movie we're going to talk about in this episode. Of course, season two of Snubs and Dubs is covering the films from the year 2014. And for episode 13, oh, wait, there was one thing that I wanted to talk about quickly.
Oh, no.
And it was a retrospective-ish Snubs and Grubs, because it's not in the early morning hours right now.
It's not. No, that's a fact.
Wendy's Canada recently launched breakfast at Wendy's.
Oh my God.
And I went this morning with the determination to come to this podcast and say, hey, I tried Wendy's breakfast and it was this.
Yes.
It's fine. Like, it was the most fast food breakfast that you could probably get.
I bet you it's probably like the same supplier as like McDonald's and Tim Hortons. Like, it's probably the exact same stuff.
Yeah, like it gave me the same feeling afterwards, maybe a little bit ickier than normal.
Oh no. I'm gonna level with you. Whenever I have McD's or Tim Hortons breakfast, which I'm not gonna lie, also decently regular,
yeah,
it happens, I never feel good.
No.
If I were to feel ickier, I would stop that one.
Yeah, I think it might have been because I tried the breakfast Baconator combo.
Oh, you went for
I went did. For the yeah, headliner. Like, I just went straight
no
there.
Opener. just hot open right into the Baconator.
Yeah, and like, it was a lot, I'll have to say. The picture makes it look like a lot more than it actually was in my hand.
It did look a little wimpy.
Yeah, especially the snaps egg, that you sent. Very thin egg.
Is the egg like the old Tim Hortons style egg where it could be styrofoam if you look at it the right way?
I don't think so, but it's not like it was, it's just very thin. I don't know what they did with it. It was like obviously cooked to shit, like there's no yolk or anything, but like it was, yeah, it was just weirdly thin. So
like, on a scale from old Timmy's to McDonald's eggs, where does this one sit?
Ooh, probably closer to old Timmy's in like three out of 10. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's a 20 scale. So, oh, jeez, you should have waited for me to tell you the numbers we're looking at, Kyle.
I will say that their potato, like their fries, were actually pretty good.
That makes sense.
Well seasoned and really crispy. And I got the frosty chino, which is like a frosty cappuccino iced thing.
Okay, that sounds rad as hell.
Yeah, it's basically like a frosty flavored iced coffee. That's the best way I can describe it.
Is it like actual ice cream in there, like an affogato?
I don't know. No. So have you had a Tim Hortons iced coffee and how it kind of tastes like a melted ice cap?
Yes.
It's like that.
Oh.
But it kind of tastes like a melted frosty with some coffee.
Interesting.
So it was good. It actually wasn't as sweet as I thought it would be,
mm-hmm,
but it was still quite sweet. It's a little sweeter than I usually go for in the mornings, but yeah.
I just wanted to say affogato so I could sound enlightened. Oh, that's Wendy's affogato, hey?
But they have other stuff that I didn't try. Like there's like a croissant sandwich or something.
That sounds like it could be good.
Could be interesting.
I love a croissant sandwich.
Yeah.
It's makes a really good bread, like bread material.
Because it's light. It's fluffy.
It's light. It's got flakes. Although, okay, I had this one. This is now breakfast Snubs and Dubs. Yeah. I had this one Eggs Benedict on a croissant.
Oh.
But it was a dense croissant. And it rocked my world.
That's interesting.
It was, I don't even remember the name of the place. I was too busy having an experience with their croissant eggs Benny. And yeah. I think of it frequently at night when I just need someone to hold me over to the next morning. I think of that one croissant eggs Benny had and it gets me there.
It's funny because like I saw an ad on TV and I don't watch a lot of TV. So it's interesting seeing ads nowadays, but like it was for a frozen pizza that has a croissant crust.
Fuck it, sure. So rock and roll, why not?
I don't know where we got to get there, but
I don't know, man. Who knows how long we all have left on this earth. Eat a croissant pizza. Yeah. Who gives a shit?
Have your slice of croissant pizza with your Coke with coffee. Yeah, like
I tried that.
Yes. Okay, here we go.
It was fine. Yeah. I tried the black. Because that was the one that was there. I didn't know there was even others.
I didn't either.
It's like a fine iced coffee. And then a shockingly long time after you drink it, you get a little Coke.
Mm.
And it was strange. Not bad. It's not a good. It's a fine iced coffee. But it's not like a good iced coffee. And it's not like a good pop. So I'm just not going to buy it again.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It was 5 out of 10.
Damn. Well, I'm kind of disappointed because my transition into this intro was really good. Okay, now I'm going to have to go in cold. So
no, just what was it?
We were talking about the movies and now I'm going into that. And then I was going to go right into the movie. It was so clean.
Yeah.
And then I remembered the snubs and grubs.
But no more imitation movies. Here's the game. Okay,
well, of course, season 2 of Snubs and Dubs is covering the films from the year 2014. And for episode 13, we are talking about The Imitation Game. We have seen this before, I recall.
We went together in theaters to see it.
I think I dragged you and my sister out there to the North Cinema to watch this movie. And I haven't seen it since then.
Me neither.
Yeah, so that was in 2014.
I remembered a lot about it, though.
Yeah.
Like watching the movie, everything felt really familiar for some reason.
Well, yeah, it's like one of those things where it's a biopic, so it's kind of like you also maybe know the true story, and maybe after we watched the movie you read up on it a little after and then you just kind of remember everything. Yeah. I don't know, but yeah, well, should we just get into it? If you were interested in The Imitation Game or the book it was based on, I've included the links to the physical media related to it in the show notes. If you buy through that link, it'll help out our show, or if you have any other Amazon shopping to do, follow our general link to help out the show in the process. Reminder that this is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation, so if you haven't seen The Imitation Game yet and you want to, go ahead and do so, but without further ado, let's get into it.
The Imitation Game is a 2014 American historical drama biopic about Alan Turing. It was directed by Morton Tilden and written by Graham Moore. It is based on the 1983 biography Alan Turing, The Enigma by Andrew Hodges, which is based on the Alan Turing, the person.
Wow.
It stars Benedict Cumberbatch as the titular Alan Turing, Keira Knightley as Joanne Clark, Matthew Good as Hugh Alexander, Rory Kinnear as Detective Robert Nock, Alan Leach as John Cairncross, and Matthew Beard as Peter Hilton. It has a runtime of 113 minutes and was released on November 28th, 2014. You probably saw it in 2015, though, because it was kind of hard to...
Oh, it was kind of hard. I remember it being winter, but honestly, winter here is like from November to March, so could have been any time.
It could have been any time. But Kyle, what did you think of The Imitation Game Round 2?
This is the most fine movie.
God, this is such a Hollywood biopic. Oh my God. Okay, going back through this, I don't know why things stuck out so clearly to me, because when I rewatched it, I'm like, oh, that was kind of bland.
Yeah.
It's just such a movie. There's so much movie per movie going on in this film. You experience it at a rate of like one movie per second. I don't know. This is like your movie little game. This is, it felt like 113 times 60 of those. I don't know. It's just... I experienced things watching this movie that I can't describe, but a lot of it was kind of boredom.
Yeah, it kind of is, because it's so safe. It is like the definition of like when people think of, oh, this is an Oscar movie. This is almost one Colin Firth away from being a definitive Oscar movie, because it's World War II, English, biopic, great performance by an A-list actor. What else? I don't know. It's just like, it is the most safe movie, though.
If they removed the running out of this movie, it would just be like a boring, not accurate documentary. Like the way they add tension is like, oh man, we need to raise the stakes here. Have them run and not explain what they're doing to each other so that everyone has to run after Alan yelling, Alan!
Yeah.
Alan, what are you doing, Alan? And then have him never explain anything. And no, that's drama.
That's it. Oh, yeah. We'll get into that after the plot. But I had one particular issue that I just like, it kept sticking out to me, but we'll get to that afterwards. Mm-hmm. So last episode, I put some time codes into the show notes. We didn't announce it because I did it afterwards, but we're going to start doing some time codes now. I'm going to just go right through the plot. If you do not need a refresher or you just don't want to know, you can skip to the time code after the plot summary. We'll leave that in the show notes. But without further ado, I'm going to break this plot right down. In 1951, two policemen, Nock and Stalk, investigate the mathematician Alan Turing after an apparent break-in at his home. During his interrogation with Nock, Turing tells of his time working at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. In 1928, the young Alan Turing is unhappy and bullied at boarding school. He develops a friendship with Christopher Morcom, who sparks his interest in cryptography. Turing develops romantic feelings for him, but Christopher soon dies from tuberculosis. When Britain declares war on Germany in 1939, Turing travels to Bletchley Park. Under the direction of Commander Alistair Denison, he joins the cryptography team of Hugh Alexander, John Carncross, Peter Hilton, Keith Furman, and Charles Richards. The team are trying to analyze the Enigma machine, which the Nazis used to send coded messages. Turing is difficult to work with and considers his colleagues inferior. He works alone to design his machine to decipher Enigma messages. After Denison refuses to fund the construction of the machine, Turing writes to Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who puts Alan Turing in charge of the team and funds the machine. Turing fires Furman and Richards and places a difficult crossword puzzle in the newsletters to find replacements. Joan Clark, a Cambridge graduate, passes Turing's test, but her parents will not allow her to work with the male cryptographers. Turing arranges for her to live and work with the female clerks who intercept the messages and shares his plans with her. With Clark's help, Turing warms to the other colleagues who begin to respect him. Turing's machine, who he names Christopher, is constructed, but cannot determine the Enigma encryption settings quickly enough. The Germans reset them every day. Denison orders it to be destroyed and Turing fired, but the other cryptographers threaten to leave if Turing goes. After Clark plans to leave on the wishes of her parents, Turing proposes marriage, which she accepts. During their reception, Turing confirms his homosexuality to Carncross, who warns him to keep it a secret. After overhearing a conversation with a female clerk about the messages she receives, Turing has an epiphany, realizing he can program the code to decode words he already knows exist in certain messages. One German coder will always open his first message with a standard plaintext German script. That reveals enough of the day's Enigma code that Christopher can quickly decode all the day's messages. After he recalibrates the machine, it quickly decodes the message and the cryptographers celebrate. They learn a convoy is about to be attacked, but Turing realizes that if they suddenly reroute the convoy and attack the U-boats, the Germans will realize Enigma is compromised and change their machinery. Therefore, the team at Bletchley Park cannot act on every decoded message. Turing creates a statistical model to indicate which warnings to send to maximize destruction and minimize discovery. Turing discovers that Carncross is the Soviet spy. When Turing confronts him, Carncross argues that the Soviets are allies working for the same goals and threatens to retaliate by disclosing Turing's sexuality. When the top MI6 agent Stuart Menzies appears to threaten Clark, Turing reveals that Carncross is the spy. Menzies reveals that he knew this already and he planted the messages Carncross leaks to the Soviets for British benefit. Fearing for her safety, Turing tells Clark to leave Bletchley Park, revealing that he is a homosexual. Clark states that she always suspected, but insists they would have been happy together anyways. Turing tells her that he never cared for her and only used her for her cryptography skills. Heartbroken, she decides to stay anyway, deeming this the single most important task she'll undertake, and now refuses to cow what Turing or her parents want her to do. After the war, Menzies tells cryptographers to destroy their work because MI6 wants governments to think they had unbreakable code machines. He tells the team that they should never see each other again or share with anyone what they've done. In 1952, Turing is convicted of gross indecency and, in lieu of a jail sentence, undergoes chemical castration so he can continue his work. Clark visits him in his home and witnesses his physical and mental deterioration. She comforts him by saying that his work saved millions of lives. The epilogue reveals that after a year of government-mandated hormonal therapy, Turing committed suicide on June 7th, 1954. In 2013, Queen Elizabeth II granted Turing a posthumous royal pardon, honoring his work, which would eventually go on to create the modern computer. But that is The Imitation Game.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, it took way less than 113 minutes that time.
Yeah, one thing about this is, like, they do try to string up the conflict. And the one thing that I was mentioning before getting into this plot is there's so much time spent to the fact that Turing is working on something else than what the other cryptographers are working on, because they spend every day trying to go through the same code breaking process and it's never working, but they're mad at him for trying something else.
Yeah. It makes no sense in the way that a team dynamic should go with multiple people trying different things. There's a bunch of these things that are just so Hollywood dramatized in a way that doesn't really feel that natural.
No,
there's a bunch of like added stakes, and like, there's a couple honestly groan-worthy moments, like when Alan Turing is almost fired, and then people like, if you fire him, will you have to fire me?
Yep.
And it's just kind of immersion breaking, because it's like, you know, this didn't happen. That's not how the military works.
And it's also contradictory to what had been previously happening, because they didn't want him to be working on this machine, I guess?
They didn't even really show a good, strong, like, arc of the team warming up to him and realizing he might have the ticket here. It's just, they hate him a couple social interactions, and now they're willing to stake their life. Because, like, in the military, if you don't follow orders, you don't just, like, get fired. You get court-martialed. Like, you get sent to prison for doing this. This isn't... You're not working at, like, BMO or, like, Microsoft and are upset about something. You get killed. Like,
and, like, I don't understand why they wanted to destroy the machine after it didn't work once.
Yeah.
They finally turn it on. It doesn't work for the first time. And then they're like, well, tear it down.
Yeah.
100,000 pounds wasted. Okay. Why? Why?
It would possibly make sense if this was about like a company drama and they had like some dumb CEOs like, well, your thing's not working, or like intentionally wanted to sabotage it.
Yeah.
But everyone is so clearly on the same team going for the same goal that like no one's actions make that much sense. Also, like, 100,000 pounds probably is a lot of money. You're in a wartime. You're printing. Who gives a shit?
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Like, like, okay, whatever, I get it. There's probably like other resource allocation you're contending with, but breaking this is so worth it. Ugh. I don't know. There's a lot of like the dramatization's kind of annoying. Like when he has his eureka moment of being like, oh, these common words are going to be in every message, so I'm going to run over and like try and crack it right now.
Yeah.
I found it was kind of annoying how they do the stupid, like, I'm going to run and not explain anyone what's happening, and then everyone's going to chase after me for 20 minutes shouting, Alan! Just, you're not in that much of a rush. Just tell him what's happening.
Yeah. I don't know. And like, it's not that this isn't competently made.
It's or competently very acted. Competently made and acted.
Yeah. It's like, it's well written because it works enough, and it's, you know, it flows as a movie and it gets all the points across that you need to get across for Alan Turing's life, I guess. And Benedict Cumberbatch is great in this.
He's fantastic.
Cannot argue that at all. It's just, like, a lot of the dramatization of these events just seems inconsequential.
Yes. It's very low stakes, the part that they try to add some like action and height to.
Yeah.
But like you said, this is a very well-made movie. Both Definitely. Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley give absolutely amazing performances. Mm. And the score is fantastic. The production in general is really good. Like, this feels so much like a movie that I wish it just had a better screenplay.
Yeah. This is another example of Keira Knightley refusing to work in like modern day settings.
Yeah, she will not do it. Maybe at this point, Benedict Cumberbatch was also in this, because he had done Sherlock, was his big thing. Like, I think he was also only doing like older British people. That was his bread and butter, especially like geniuses who are hinted to be like somewhat on the spectrum.
Yeah,
that was really every role that had those things on that. Benedict Cumberbatch is your man.
Yeah. I just realized that this kind of goes back to our first episode when we were not doing the seasons, but when we talked about Atonement, I was going to ask, like, oh, did you like this Keira Knightley performance better than the Atonement performance? But then I realized Benedict Cumberbatch was also in Atonement.
He was also in that one. And I remembered that he was in Atonement, but I kind of forgot he was in that.
I like totally forgot too until I just took a second. I was like, wait, yeah.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, they're good in both. World War II movies.
But, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, he excels here. Like, he's
good. It is a masterful performance. Mm-hmm. And I did some homework on the real life Alan Turing. I did not read the book. I don't have time for that. You get what we are paid, which is nothing. I read a couple articles online, which is as good a source as an entire biography.
Yeah.
And it kind of, you can expect to know what did and didn't happen.
Mm.
Like, there was no big eureka moment. They cracked it kind of early on. Also, one thing that annoyed me both times I watched the movie is, why did the code breakers, why are they now the strategists of what they release and what that clearly that should be with the higher in command authority.
Yeah.
And in actuality, it was, they would just break the codes and pass them on. And then the actual like military strategists and not linguists and mathematicians would decide how to act on that, which made a lot more sense. It was like decently accurate. A lot of the characters never actually interacted with Alan Turing. Like, Karen Cross is a real person who really gave out secrets to the Soviets. They never talked to Turing. They never had their path crossed. There was, that's fabricated. Huh. A lot of the inaccuracy is how Alan Turing's portrayed. He's not the kind of awkward, socially inept genius that Benedict Cumberbatch plays in every single movie.
Right.
He apparently was a pretty outgoing guy, not even the best clean cut, so he wouldn't do that weird peas and carrots separation thing. Huh. A lot of the story of him as a young kid, very accurate. He did get nailed underneath wooden boards at his boarding school.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
Yeah, a lot of that was actually pretty accurate. He knew his friend was going to die before he died, but that's a pretty minor thing. That's But for the most part, like, the story's good enough that when I was reading what did and didn't happen, the stuff that didn't happen that was added in was like, okay, basic movie, kind of gossing it up to be better.
Mm.
It's not, even like family of Alan Turing has said that it does honor their uncle fairly well. So it's good enough.
Yeah, that's fine. I saw on a YouTube short that Benedict Cumberbatch is like 13th cousin to Alan Turing or something.
Oh, wow.
So somewhat connected.
I mean, it's an island, the British. I'm sure they're all 13th cousins to each other. That's how that works.
Well, what did the critics and audiences think of this movie? I'm curious to know. It was obviously a Best Picture nominee.
It was.
But that usually coincides with some high reviews.
Oh, the critics and audiences thought of this regularly and highly.
Okay.
Critics on Rotten Tomatoes, 89. Yeah. Audiences, 91.
Oh, wow. So pretty much around the same. Just a couple points different.
IMDb, an 8. And Metacritic, 71. So this is a highly regarded movie, but this is a movie's movie. Mm-hmm. This has all the buzz of an Oscars baity kind of movie.
Yep.
It also, despite a limited release initially, it pulled.
Yeah.
It made $227 million on a budget of $14
million. Oh, wow.
Are you kidding me?
This does not look like a $14 million movie.
No, they really stretched the budget. So much smoother.
Yeah.
Yeah. This came in at number 37 at the box office.
Damn, pretty good.
Yeah, for a biopic.
Yeah.
Whew, that's doing pretty good. But let's get to the better scores. Ours. Okay. Kyle, hit me with your enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. I put a 3. Because I didn't hate it. Mm-hmm. I liked about 60% of it, which, you know, that's 3 out of 5.
That is, right on the money.
It's just like, some of the extra dramatization was just not working for me in some cases. And like, for the most part, it's kind of boring.
Yes.
But like, it keeps you entertained enough to get you through the 113 minutes. And so, I was about at a 3.
Absolutely. I concur minus 0.5. I'm going to slide this a 2.5 because I enjoyed about 50% of it.
Sure.
Which is average, right down the middle. Your crafty time.
I gave it a 4. Hearing that the budget was quite low, actually, I was thinking about putting it a little higher, but I think 4 is good because it is it is well shot. The locations, costumes, score, all good. So I think 4 is pretty safe.
I also slapped down a 4 on this one.
Nice.
I concur entirely. What's your execution?
I wrote a 4, but I think I'm going to put 3.5 actually. It's mostly lacking in some of the writing and just like the dramatization again, but the acting does bring it up, mostly on the back of Benedict Cumberbatch. Keira Knightley does a good job too, but it is kind of like his movie.
Yes, absolutely.
And everyone around him is pretty much just fine. No one stands out as being a bad actor. So that's, 3.5.
Yeah, I also gave this a 3.5. Nice. I'm kind of thinking the same thing. Benedict does an amazing job. Keira Knightley does a very, very good job.
Yeah.
Everyone else does what they need to do to get it done. Mm-hmm. That's a 3.5 in my books. Yep. And rewatchability.
2.
Oh my God. Did you read my scores?
I did not. You jerk. And it's funny because I'm even reading my scores and I think they're a little bit higher than I actually felt. And so, yeah, I think 2, because I wrote 2.5 initially and I'm like thinking back of it. I don't think I would ever watch this again, but if somebody put it on, I wouldn't be opposed. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't like yell at them for watching that movie. Like, you can't get angry at somebody wanting to watch The Imitation Game with you. It's just like a boring choice.
Yeah. I put down a 2 for this one.
Yeah.
I think when I had first watched it, I would probably score it at like a 3 for rewatchability, and watching it again, ooh, I'm kind of good. Like, yeah. I've extracted everything I need from this movie and have really no interest in seeing it again, but there are worse ways to spend 113 minutes. So I'm not going to drop it lower than that. Well, cool. Kyle, you have given this a 12.5. out of 20 for a 63%, and I have given this a 12 out of 20 for a 60%.
Well,
but we are in pretty close agreement there.
Yeah.
Moving along, we have some fun
rankings.
Rankings. I was on the wrong part of the page. Kyle, where would you like to slot The Imitation Game into your rankings? Would you like me to read them off?
Sure, you can read them off.
All right. You have, from top to bottom, Grand Budapest Hotel, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Interstellar, Gone Girl, Nightcrawler, Lego, John Wick, Boyhood, Babadook, Big Hero 6, Foxcatcher, American Sniper.
This is my new number 10. It is going in below Boyhood, but above Big Hero 6.
It would be below Babadook.
Oh.
But also technically still below Boyhood.
Yeah.
Number 10. So that's fine. I'm not gonna,
my bad.
I'm not going to call you on that. I totally called him. I'm going to be around the same neighborhood. It's kind of hard to think of which exact movie it's going to beat. I think I'm going to put it as my number 11. So below Big Hero 6 and above Foxcatcher. It kind of, it gives me Foxcatchery vibes in the level of excitement I had. Maybe, but it beats it a little bit. It's slightly more entertaining than Foxcatcher was. But now that those are slotted in, it is time for some fun Letterboxd reviews.
Oh, baby. Was there some juicy fun to be had in the Letterboxd reviews for Imitation Game? Or were there essays?
Kind
of. I feel like this is kind of an essay.
Kind of. This is one where I started by going off activity and then quickly just had to go to the worst rated because that was where more of the fun was at. But we do have one entertaining one in the higher scores. Ella, 3.5. Keira Knightley, I'd willingly do math for you. That was a good one. And then we went into the basement after that because I went through several pages of nothing good. One small NB, 0.5 stars. A disgrace to the legacy of Alan Turing. Benedict Cumberbatch, meet me in a Denny's parking lot.
Wow.
I don't know if it's a disgrace, but I would love to see Benedict Cumberbatch scrap with some random person from Letterboxd in a Denny's parking lot.
Does Alan Turing just have like a very lively fan base of people that are willing to fight A-list beloved celebrity Benedict Cumberbatch because of his portrayal?
We were writing this on computers, so we do owe him one. And if you're if you don't like his portrayal and you have in your hand the technology called a cell phone or a computer, you deserve to clock Benedict Cumberbatch once. That's all you get, though. You have to show some restraint.
Yeah.
Twink182, a fantastic name. I really loved it. That's
quality. That's quality.
One star. Successful imitation of being boring. Well, I think a lot more creativity went into the name.
Their name is quality.
Yeah. And then there was a joke that I knew had to be in here somewhere. So I went looking for it and I couldn't find it.
Wow. Okay.
So I did it. Yeah. Snubs and Dubs, 1.5 stars. The imitation lame.
Nice. There you go.
Did you see I lifetime inputted our scores in?
Yeah.
While I was scrolling around to stall for time, I added a review into the, so it's already in there.
Nice. Great.
Well, people loved it a lot more are the Academy.
I figured.
This was nominated for 8 awards.
Wow.
Best Picture.
Yep.
Best Adapted Screenplay. Best Actor. Best Supporting Actress, Best Directing, Best Film Editing, Best Original Score, and Best Production. Kyle, I don't know if you would be able to guess which one it actually won, so I'm going to give you the mic. Ooh. What do you think it won? It only won one of these.
Production design?
Nope. Best Adapted Screenplay.
What the fuck?
The thing we probably disliked the most about it was its only win at the Academy Awards. That is a bizarre choice.
Wow.
I get the nomination. This was written to get that nomination.
For sure.
And then didn't go anywhere after that.
Huh. I mean, I understand some of the other nominations. Benedict Cumberbatch makes sense to me.
Yeah.
The production design, score, editing probably. I mean, like, directing, competently directed,
very competently directed.
But like Keira Knightley, yeah, sure, that's fine.
I find she might get bumped in our end of season rewrite. She may be on the chopping block.
Yeah, I could see that too.
Mostly, the performances have lived on longer than a lot of the rest of the movie.
Oh yeah,
despite it still being reviewed very highly. Mm-hmm. But the standout from this movie is probably Benedict Cumberbatch. Definitely. He got a lot of action going on from movie. Do you want some interesting facts?
Hit me with those interesting facts.
There was quite a few. There is actually a rich world around this real story, which makes sense.
Yep.
Really happened. Alan Turing is shown running in various scenes. There's more. I just wanted to fake you out there. It's never mentioned in the film, but he was a world-class distance runner. In 1946, he ran a marathon in 2 hours and 46 minutes.
I'm still laughing at the alternative scene running. I wonder if we can add facts to IMDb and just cut the rest of the sentences after these facts.
Alan Turing is depicted walking. Okay. On November 27th, 2014, ahead of the film's U.S. release, the New York Times reprinted the original 1942 crossword puzzle from the Daily Telegraph that was used to recruit codebreakers at Bletchley Park during World War II. Entrants who solved the puzzle could mail in their results for a chance to win a trip for two to London and a tour of the famous Bletchley Park facilities.
Cool.
Yeah, that's pretty wicked.
That's cool.
I don't know why they're punishing winners for going to London, though. Come on. Commander Dennison says that he has just rejected one of our great nation's top linguists, knows German better than Bertolt Brecht. That linguist was possibly J.R.R. Tolkien, writer of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings books, who learned German from his mother. In January 1939, Tolkien was asked whether, in the event of national emergency, he would be prepared to work in the cryptographical department of the Foreign Office. He agreed and apparently attended a 4-day course of instruction at the Foreign Office beginning on March 27th. In October 1939, he was told that his services would not be required and never worked as a cryptographer.
Wow.
That's kind of funny. That's kind of something, hey?
Yeah, imagine if he had spent his time doing other things instead of writing The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings.
You cracked the code. Tolkien says the Germans are walking for several days.
That's cool. That's interesting.
That's interesting. I always thought he was World War I era. I don't know why. I think he's older than he is.
Yeah.
Alex Lothar, who plays the young Turing, and Benedict Cumberbatch both wore dentures in the film, which were exact copies of Alan Turing's own 60-year-old set of false teeth.
That's grossed me out.
That dedication.
I recoiled there for a moment.
So if you think about all the inaccuracies they put in the movie, those teeth are spot on, baby. They didn't mess there.
Why do we have exact copies of Alan Turing's teeth?
Well, I guess if you just have dentures and...
I guess
they just weren't thrown out, I guess. My question is, why bother putting them in the movie? That's not my main takeaway. I'm not pulling out my ruler to measure teeth gaps, you guys. Like, I don't care.
Someone in the costume or makeup department, that was like their baby. That was like, they went hard to make sure that those teeth were exact.
They just had someone's nephew came to the set, and to give that person a job, they're like, you're on teeth duty. Make sure the teeth are right.
And he was determined. Like, he was really wanted to make it in. He was his make or break it moment. And he,
Mark Strong's character, Stuart Menzies, is the basis for James Bond's Boss M.
Cool.
Yeah. M stands for Menzies.
Interesting. I liked Mark Strong in this movie.
Oh yeah, he's really good. Yeah. It's small role, but like he kills it. Yeah.
And I mean, like, he doesn't do like much. He kind of has one mood.
Yeah.
But it's like this suave type of thing.
He kills it. And lastly, in its review of the film, the New York Times indicated a parental warning for advanced mathematics. The complete notice reads, "The Imitation Game is rated PG-13, parents strongly cautioned, for illicit sex, cataclysmic violence, and advanced math." Most of it mentioned rather than shown.
That's interesting what was in the PG-13 and not the explicit mentions of homosexuality. That's when I think of like a fact that would be like, oh, they rated it this because of this, like, that's what I think of. But I'm glad that it was math.
It was math.
That?
Yeah, it's a graphic depiction of math.
That just reminded me of neighbor girl burp and fart in the IMDb. Burp Ed.
I forgot about that.
That's such quality shit.
Okay, I'm done. That's my part.
All right. Well,
final thoughts on The Imitation Game.
I watched this on Tuesday, and if I didn't read that plot off, it would already been out of my brain. So
yeah, it's a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like this is one that's going to continue to be buried and drop down the list of our rankings as we get through the next 13 movies.
13 movies.
Yes.
Yes. That's advanced mathematics. Put a warning in.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for listening to season 2, episode 13 of Snubs and Dubs. As always, you can find us everywhere on social media at Snubs and Dubs. That's on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Letterboxd, etc. We're also on Good Pods, so make sure to check us out there and join our official Discord. We'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on Imitation Game or on this episode. So please send us a tweet or a message with a question, recommendation, or anything else. I'm also at Kyle Tobiasen on Twitter, and Jason is at Wendy_Mills. Of course, all of those links are going to be in the show notes. Make sure to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Share the show to everyone you know and check back next week for another episode. Here's a sneak peek of the films.
Oh,
yep. Plural. Oh. That we're going to talk about.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier. He's a ghost. You'll never find him.
Shield to protect people. Captain, to build a better world sometimes means tearing the old one down, and that makes enemies.
Peter Jason Quill, he's also known as Star-Lord.
Who calls him that?
Himself, mostly. He's wanted largely on charges of minor assault, public intoxication, and fraud.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know how this machine worked.
That's right. Next time we're doing a big old mid-season Marvel episode. So make sure to watch both Guardians of the Galaxy and Captain America: The Winter Soldier before next episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Thanks for listening. That's a wrap. Bye.
Bye for now.